From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the tiny hairs of a bee. Maybe you haven't thought much about bee hair, but in a new piece for National Geographic Magazine Online, journalist and bee researcher Matt Kelly makes the case that maybe you should. He writes that as bees travel throughout the day, their hairs become electrostatically charged and attract particles. Particles like pollen, yes, plant debris, wax, even bits of other bees. And now, Kelly writes, another material has been added to that list. Microplastics. Researchers in Denmark are studying how honeybees are carrying and scattering 13 different synthetic polymers. The bees have become a way to measure the presence of microplastics in our environment. According to National Geographic, microplastics are now in virtually every crevice on Earth, and some are so tiny that they are part of the dust that blows around the planet. So what does all of this mean for the bees? Does it pose a threat to their health? And what about humans? Researchers, including RIT Associate Professor Christy Tyler, say it's estimated that each week, humans are ingesting microplastics in an amount that is equivalent to the size of a credit card. Don't eat your credit cards. I have no idea if that's a bad amount, but that doesn't sound good. This hour, we're joined by experts who discuss microplastics, how they spread, how they're consumed, and what this all means for humans and for the bees. I'd like to welcome our guests now. Matt Kelly is an independent journalist and creator and editor of The Bee Report. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Evan.
Christy Tyler, associate professor in the Thomas H. Gosnell School of Life Sciences in the College of Science of RIT. Christy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Greg Medeski is founder and CEO of Parvario, a company that has started testing for trace plastics in Western New York water supplies. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
You know, Matt, the poor bees, man, like the bees cannot catch a break. Every year it's just something else that the bees, I really feel for the bees. So before we even get into the plastics part, in general, how are bees doing?
How are bees doing? Yes. Wow, ask me a big, broad question.
I know. Well, I'm always worried about, like, you hear all these stories that, you know, all these different theorized ideas about why the bees are dying in certain numbers or if the hives are threatened. Generally speaking, how would you assess bee health?
Joking aside, bees are doing well. And it's important to remember that there are 4,000 different types of bees in North America. Most of the time people are talking about honeybees, which is what the microplastic study was on. Mm-hmm. But there are so many different types of bees. The majority of them are single mothers. They're not part of a hive. They live in the ground. They live for one season, raising a small brood of, baby bees. And then they're done. And so most of the bees that we actually experience in life, whether we recognize it or not, are those individual solitary bees that are living in the ground. By and large, I think bees are doing pretty well, and I say that because of how much attention they're getting. It was only 10, 15 years ago where every bee was a honeybee, and nobody really cared about all the other types, but now we actually care. So if that's sort of a metric, I think they're doing pretty well. But that being said, we're learning a lot more, and there's a lot of different ways that humans have a relationship with bees beyond just the honey or the pollination. And we're discovering how impactful not only are they on our lives, but we are on their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think that's really, really well said. By the way, when you talk about, the majority of what we see, and we see those ground hives, every April, I think it's mid to late April, I see hundreds of individual single ground hives. I don't know if it was you. I think I might've learned from you that those are homes in the grass and the ground in my yard to a single bee right there in the ground. And they're not there for very long. They're there for a few weeks. It seems like they do their job getting the yard ready for spring. And then I don't know where they go, but they're gone. That's normal.
Well, right. And so the life cycle of a solitary bee is fascinating because 90% of it is underground in the dark. These adult solitary bees are only out for 4 to 6 to 8 weeks, and they're madly collecting pollen and trying to provision, these little nests for the young that are going to gestate and hatch and start to develop underground to come out the next spring or the next summer. to do the job for 4 to 8 weeks to have it all start all over again. So, yeah.
And then they die after 4 to 8 weeks?
They hang around, but their job's kind of done.
Yeah. I have this vision that they're like heading north to Canada or they're going to south to Mexico. They're like on vacation. They did their job. I don't want to hear that they died, but I'm grateful for them anyway, I guess is what I'm saying.
You should be grateful for them, absolutely.
Because you have said, I think, on this program a number of times, if you can, please don't spray. Please don't try to nuke, these hives. Please understand the role that they play, even in our neighborhoods, in our yards. Because I think I grew up at a time where the disposition that I knew from a lot of people, and probably my mother included, was see a bee, kill a bee, see a hive, kill the hive. I think that's changing a little too. Do you agree, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I said I think the attention that bees get is a good sign of the direction we're moving in. Just very quickly, though, I think it's also important to distinguish between bees and what people think are bees. Not everything that is yellow and striped and might poke you is a bee. In fact, 95% of the time, that's not what a bee is. So most of the time when people are concerned about what they might get stung by or that giant ground nest that they're seeing in the ground, probably wasps or hornets, the thing I come back to is we want to create space for these creatures, no matter where we are, whether you're in downtown Rochester or out here in the Finger Lakes in a really, really rural environment. We want to create space for them, but, we also do need to balance it with safety. And we need to balance it against, in the case of carpenter bees, which is something that people ask about, they can cause damage to your homes. So if you're going to have to manage those creatures to prevent harm or damage, do it thoughtfully. Don't just nuke everything in sight. Don't use neonicotinoid sprays, which stay in the ground and in the water and in plant material for years and years and years. You want to be thoughtful about it. So,
And how did you happen upon the story of bees and plastic, Matt?
Oh, that's literally just having my ear to the ground, staying abreast of like every bit of information about bees that I can acquire. It just happened to come across my desk and I was like, that's a cool story, mainly because when we're talking about bees specifically, but I think this also applies to microplastics. We know very little about microplastics or plastics impact on bees and even life in general. I mean, this is something we're really just starting to discover. And when it comes to monitoring microplastics in the environment, part of the concern, part of the tension, part of the imperativeness of this is we know microplastic is having an impact. We're seeing it. We can document it. We know that it's super pervasive. We know that it's, and I don't want to sound dramatic, but literally can be raining out of the sky in places where you wouldn't expect it. And yet we don't yet have a solid toolkit of tools to go out and consistently monitor it. And these are things that we have to develop. These are things that we have to start understanding.
Professor Tyler, how do we define what microplastic is?
So microplastic is any plastic that's smaller than 5 millimeters. So it can be plastic that's manufactured at that size. So microbeads were something that were in the news a few years back, mm-hmm. and that have in New York State now have been banned because they were so prevalent in all of our waterways. But then microplastic can also be formed in the environment as bigger plastic breaks down. So a plastic bag or a plastic bottle, they last for a very long time in the environment, but eventually do turn into little fragments because of UV light or waves, temperature, and even microorganisms that can break them down. And so you can get the formation of microplastic in the environment.
Is most microplastic not visible to our eye?
Yes. It's a really big range until you get to kind of nanoplastic, which mm-hmm. is even smaller than that. So it's 5 millimeters. You certainly can see half a centimeter. But going smaller than that, you definitely need a microscope. And that's part of, you know, with what Matt was saying about how it's, we don't have great tools yet to really measure the plastic that's out there. A lot of it is because so much of it is so small. I think we're developing more consistent tools with microplastics, but when you get into nanoplastics, it's really hard to measure. And it also, I think, an important point is that we talk about plastic pollution as if it's a single contaminant, like DDT, but it actually is thousands of different kinds of materials that we kind of lump all together in this plastic category, which is really just the that it's all made essentially from fossil fuels, these carbon polymers. But it really is a huge number of different chemicals that have all kinds of different dyes or flame retardants or UV protectants added to it to make it useful. And so it's a challenging problem because it's not just one problem. It's really a lot of different chemicals that
sure.
are getting out there.
And then the hard part, you know, sort of for the, I think the lay public is figuring out cumulatively how much becomes dangerous. Because as I mentioned at the outset here, you know, your work indicates that we are ingesting microplastics at a rate that generates roughly the size of a credit card in our bodies a week. That seems like a lot to me. Should I be concerned about that?
Yeah, so that wasn't our work. That was a study actually that was done in Australia. But yes, I think it absolutely should give you pause that there's enough plastic in what we're consuming in our food that we're ingesting that amount. And you know, that was an interesting study because they just really looked at the measurements of microplastics in different food sources and then looked at kind of the average diet and said, wow, this is actually really a lot of plastic that people are consuming. And I think one of the main reasons that it gives me pause is that we don't know the impact on our bodies. And the impact on the environment, we're only just starting to scratch the surface of it. So for sure, I think we should be concerned. And there's a lot that we need to work on. I think as scientists, we have a big job ahead of us to figure out what is the impact of all of this plastic, and then how can we direct our efforts to figure out where to start in terms of which one is the worst? Where do we start with preventing this from getting out into our food source and into our waterways, into our water supply? So we have our work cut out for us.
Yeah, and Professor Tyler, you know, understanding that plastics have done some important good things for mankind, we also now recognize that, you know, the fossil fuel consumption needed to create plastics is a big cost in and of itself, to say nothing about how recyclable or not many plastics are and how shocking it is to find out how often we assume because it's the word plastic that it can be recycled when it cannot. If it ends up in landfills or sort of gums up the works at these recycling centers. But then when you think about microplastics and the impact on our bodies, is this just another data point that says to you that it is valuable for all of us to keep working on finding alternatives? Not to like condemn plastics forever, but the notion of reducing plastic creation is valuable, and this is another data point. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I also agree with your very first point about that I don't think we should be demonizing all plastics.
Mm-hmm.
They are incredibly useful. I mean, I think you look around your office, I think for all of us, wherever we're sitting right now or people driving in their cars, listening to the radio.
It's everywhere.
A lot of your – it's everywhere. It's really useful. And so I think that there's a lot of nuance to it in terms of figuring out – which ones should we try to find replacements for quickly and be, you know, on the alert for how we can replace the use in our environment or in our daily lives? You know, the very first step is definitely to stop making so much of it, and then work on reuse and recycling. But the reduce part of it really is, I think, the key fact to start with.
Greg Medeski is the founder of Parvario. And can you start by telling listeners what it is that Parvario is and does?
Yeah, so we're a new startup company formed during the pandemic, and we examine your drinking water for microplastics, specifically the smallest microplastics that we think are most likely to be harmful. This is, you know, most of the research out there on microplastics deals with the larger sizes of microplastics, things that are maybe above 100 microns in size. That's about 50 times less than that minimum cutoff that Professor Tyler talked about. But I'm really interested in this very smallest fraction, this 1 to 10 micron size range, where potentially they could be absorbed in the body rather than passing through you. So we sell a home water test. We'll send you a vial, and you can send it back to us, and we'll image it and stain it and tell you exactly how much you're drinking.
Wow. Okay, but similar to what I asked Professor Tyler about, let me ask you a little bit more about this, Greg. I mean, I think it would be fascinating to find out how much plastic's in the water that we're drinking. But in the same way that I am always careful whenever I see an ingredient list for vaccines or whenever I hear that there was some level of arsenic or something in water or food source, a lot of it's about sort of thresholds of harm here. And I don't know what the thresholds of harm is for plastic. So are you giving people information but also context, if that makes sense?
Yeah, there's an old saying in toxicology, right? The dose makes the poison, right? So there's a really great graphic from Chelsea Rochman at the University of Toronto that shows the concentrations of plastic that are found in the environment and the concentrations of plastic in which we test these, you know, health claims in vitro or in model organisms. And right now, you know, this distribution says that, you know, for most intents and purposes, we're about 100 times below that threshold. So, you know, when I think of the risk from microplastic harm, I'm thinking that you may be acutely exposed, you know, where you're drinking it. There's no reason to say that you can be drinking just on a certain day, you know, 100 or 200 times more than you would normally expect. So that's kind of the context I think about when I think about, you know, drinking microplastics.
What's your biggest concern long term if we don't see intervention in some way, whether it's the kind of knowledge that you're seeking with your company to offer, policy, et cetera? What's the big concern long term with this, Greg?
Yeah, long-term, as everyone has already noted, plastics are very useful. And, you know, at the current rates of manufacturing, we're going to be doubling the amount of plastic that humanity has produced, about 4 billion tons, in the next 10 to 15 years. And there's never been as much plastic on the planet as there has been right now. So, you know, I think the risk is we don't do anything. These plastics find their way into the environment. They break down and potentially absorb nasty stuff along with it, things like lead or arsenic or PFAS or any of the other kinds of harmful molecules that others have noted, you know, plastic can absorb. And I think, you know, with more testing that needs to be done, obviously, we need to basically investigate, you know, how bioavailable those harmful substances are. Can they cross some of the barriers and release their toxic load? So I think the risk is increasing over time, not diminishing over time, especially if we do nothing.
I've got some feedback from listeners, which we'll get to in just a moment here. But before we do that, just understanding how humans and how bees are impacted. Starting on humans, Greg, is this a case where when human beings are ingesting microplastics, I mean, you're testing water, but most of the time, are we drinking microplastics? Are we inhaling it sort of through the air, ingesting in other ways? How are we getting most of it?
So definitely drinking is part of it. It's a smaller proportion than I would normally expect, you know, maybe 10% sometimes. Most of it is inhaled or ingested through food. They're comparatively larger particles by mass sometimes, and that can show that, you know, you're basically getting a lot of a plastic pellet in with your rice grain or something, and that would be counted as a microplastic. So, you know, I think we really have to take care of, you know, how we're ingesting and drinking, you know, our food and drink.
Sure. So that's the human side of things. Matt Kelly, what about the bees here? Are microplastics harming them?
That is a great question that's only been looked at recently. There was recent research, and you know, I think, you know, because there's so little research across the board, it's you know, we have to kind of be careful with some of these results initially because they haven't been replicated or we only have a single data point. So just kind of putting that out there up front. But some recent research that was published earlier this year showed that consuming microplastics, which honeybees are likely to do if it's getting on their body and getting into their honey, can disrupt their microbiome, which is obviously essential to like a whole ton of biological functions like processing nectar and regulating the immune system and dealing with all the pathogens they have to deal with. But an interesting thing they also found in that study was that when bees consume microplastics and also consume a common antibiotic used in beekeeping, the mortality rate shot up dramatically. And so it's not just for any organism, it's not just the issue of consuming the direct impact that the microplastic might have, but the combined effects that it could have, whether those microplastics are giving off toxins that are inherently part of the process, like Dr. Tyler was talking about, or whether they're absorbing other substances out of the environment. We know that microplastics can absorb pesticides, for example. And so if creatures ingest those, maybe the plastics aren't hurting them, but then you have like this wonderful delayed release that's occurring over many, 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 many days in the gut of this creature. So those are those are some of the initial findings they've had with honeybees, but I think are worth considering for organisms at large.
And I appreciate sort of the sober look at this situation, saying there's still a lot we don't know. There's a lot of research that has to be done. So I don't want to get overly speculative, but I do want to at least sort of realistically to know what your concern is. I mean, I asked Greg about, you know, sort of long-term, the outlook here, if there isn't sort of intervention. What are you most concerned about with bees here, Matt?
I think what I'm most concerned about at this point is ignoring the problem, is thinking that it's not going to be an issue and not putting the time and the energy into figuring out the sort of impacts it could have on these creatures. You know, the honeybee study that you started the conversation with in Denmark, you know, the bees weren't ingesting the microplastics. It was just accumulating on their body, which coincidentally is a potentially great tool for monitoring airborne microplastics, in particular, you know, areas and locations. So that's a cool kind of tool. But, you know, are they spreading it also? Are they becoming a vector for this? That's an interesting question. Honeybees might be more likely to survive the impact of microplastics, whether direct or combined, because they are a hive, they are a superorganism, whereas the majority of bees are solitary. They're single mothers living in the ground. You kill them off once, they're done. Like, there's no hive to kind of absorb that impact. So those are the things that would concern me about this.
Well, can you sort of refresh us? Yeah, I think you mentioned at the outset here, 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot of assumption that most bees people ever saw were honeybees. There wasn't as much interest in differentiating or understanding the diversity of bees, how they impact the environment. But we did know over the last 10 to 15 years that there were die-offs or hive problems, and there was a lot of speculation. So, we're learning about microplastics in bees right now. In those recent years, was there a single most common culprit when the bees were threatened? I mean, was it pesticides or otherwise, Matt?
Where I think most researchers are coming down on now is three main impacts that we know of. One is climate change, one is pesticide, and one is urban development, so disrupting habitats. And that can be in any sort of, oh, and I'm sorry, I should add a fourth. This is an important one too, that we're only now just appreciating, is the spread of pathogens. You know, bees, like any organism, whether they're honeybees or mason bees or sweat bees, are going to be exposed to any number of pathogens in the environment. Because we are managing bees at these massive scales to pollinate our farm systems, which we need to do, we're also spreading all sorts of bee-based diseases around the country, and we're just beginning to appreciate how those might be impacting different species outside of those managed bees. There's the Western honeybee is this awesome big bee that lives just out on the West Coast. It has almost virtually disappeared, and that timing of disappearance coincided with an outbreak of commercial bees, or an outbreak of a specific disease with commercial bees in the West. So those are the four main, you know, those four main things, climate change, urban development, pesticides, and pathogens are in some combination or another, or what researchers are really looking at right now. And so, I don't know, microplastics become a fifth? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we're going to find out. And after our only break here, we've got questions from the audience for our all three of our guests on these subjects here. You know, we've known for a long time that plastics in the ocean are so large they form landmasses visible from a long way away, and we've sort of just tolerated that. But when plastics come for the bees, we're drawing a line in the sand. We're trying to find out just exactly what it means that bees are carrying around microplastics, and it may be impacting their own lives, and what that means for all of our ecosystems and for us. Matt Kelly, an independent journalist and creator and editor of The Bee Report. Christy Tyler is an associate professor in the Thomas H. Gosnell School of Life Sciences in the College of Science at RIT. And Greg Medeski is founder and CEO of Parvario, a company that has started testing for trace plastics in Western New York water supplies. Your questions after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson, Monday on The Next Connections. School superintendents have a lot of work to do, looking ahead not just to the summer, but to the fall, planning for students back in the classrooms in many schools full-time, no remote at all. But what does that mean for masking, for safety? What are some of the guidelines that they will follow? How do you feel about that with kids being back in school full-time next fall? We'll talk to superintendents Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about bees, microplastics, the impact on bees, and the impact of microplastics on us in our drinking water, in our food supplies, and in our environment. And so this new research on how even bees are carrying and perhaps scattering microplastics is just another data point for how much plastic is out there, how much we are consuming, whether we know it or not. And we've got a number of questions from listeners already lined up here, so let me work through some of them. Benjamin says, I agree that we shouldn't demonize all plastic, but we should certainly demonize the industry as a whole. They pushed for no recycling. They said it was harmless. They misled us. In my view, no more non-recyclable plastics should be made, or at the very least, a drop-dead date for them to end production should be set. That's from Benjamin. Dr. Tyler, what do you think about that?
I think it sounds great, but I think, you know, I think there's some phasing in of some of these new regulations. I mean, there's a new potential regulation that's working its way in New York State about requiring packaging producers to basically pay for the recycling, take back and recycling. I think that there's a lot of ways that we need to figure out how to do a better job with this. And I think that the idea that plastics are harmless is something that was marketed with the advent of plastics and the growth of the plastics industry in the 1950s. And it's something we're only really now realizing that they last a really long time in the environment. And even with recyclable plastic, we have the potential for escape into the environment. And so not only do we need to work on the the recycling, but we need to make sure that it gets into the proper waste stream in the first place. Because we find so much plastic in the environment that has escaped from the traditional waste stream or the recycling waste stream anyways. So I think that we really need a multifaceted approach on how to address that problem.
Greg Medeski, what do you make of Benjamin's email on putting a sunset date on the production of non-recyclable plastics worldwide?
Yeah, I think it's a great goal. The problem is, of course, they're everywhere right now, and they're incredibly useful. So finding substitutes is a key thing that needs to happen. As Christy noted, there's a need for a large multi-stakeholder solution to really address this problem in its whole. It's a very complicated problem, and there's a lot of features to it. So, I think it's a very worthy goal to try and eliminate all that single-use plastic.
Matt Kelly, what do you think?
I would take the thinking on this even a little further. As Dr. Tyler pointed out, even when we recycle plastics, that can generate microplastics, right? Because you're crunching this stuff up and you're breaking it down and you're trying to turn it into something else. And there's always the potential for that to escape. I think that what we really need to start thinking about is, creating plastics out of natural substances that are going to biodegrade and not exist as some sort of synthetic material in the environment. One of the things that was really fascinating to me, and I'm sure I might get this wrong, so any historians on plastic out there, please correct me on this. But plastics, in terms of a material we use to make things as humans, actually originated in the 1800s, and they were natural materials. They were, we used resins and all sorts of other sort of animal-based materials to create what was called plastic. And then the plastic that we know today is actually a synthetic plastic. And so it may just be a matter of trying to figure out how to go back to roots on this and create those, plastic as it was originally envisioned, which is those sort of natural-based substances.
Kara writes to say, would it be safer for me and my family to be drinking bottled water and not from the tap? I assume not if it comes from a plastic bottle, but I don't know about microplastics. Greg Medeski, anything you want to add there for Kara?
Yeah, so there's been quite a bit of study on microplastics in bottled water. There was a study in Europe that showed it varied wildly by branding. Different brands of bottled water will have different amounts of microplastics in the bottles with them. It's probably due to the result of the actual bottling process. Every time you unscrew a cap like that, you're putting a little mechanical wear on the plastic, and it'll splinter and potentially fall into the water. So the amount of exposure for any particular water source can vary wildly, orders of magnitude. Many different kinds of concentrations out there. If you wanted to protect yourself a little better, I always recommend that people filter their water. There aren't any particular microplastic standards yet, but we're working on trying to certify some water filters that do address, these microplastics in these small ranges that could be impactful to human health.
And Greg and Dr. Tyler, for people who might not be aware or missed it, can you talk just a little bit about microplastics research efforts locally here? I'll start with Greg.
Yeah, there's a working group over here at the University of Rochester, and Christy or Dr. Tyler can speak about the research at RIT. But they're very interested in examining, microplastics that are airborne, collecting these small ones that are really potentially have the ability to move into human tissues. Really charting out the concentrations of microplastics in this size range that are present all around us, basically. Trying to do that more efficiently is going to be important to really nailing down the scope of this problem.
Dr. Tyler, you want to elaborate there?
Sure, yeah. So at RIT, we've got a plastic research team. It's an interdisciplinary team, which I think is appropriate for the scope and nature of the problem. So it includes an engineer and a biochemist, a math modeler, a chemist, and then me, I'm an ecologist. and a huge number of students. And one of the primary projects we're working on right now involves looking at the impact of plastic, different types of plastics, on Lake Ontario and in some of the waterways that lead into Lake Ontario. So we're looking at what happens to the plastic after it enters the environment. How does it age? How does it break down? How does the chemistry change? Does it become more toxic? And then looking at the effect on different model organisms, and then also on things like algal production and nutrient cycling in these different systems.
What's the timeline for getting some answers on answering these questions?
We are wrapping up a big year-long experiment right now, so hopefully pretty soon. We've got some really interesting preliminary results, you know, just kind of jumping off of some of what Matt was talking about earlier about, you know, plastics potentially being more toxic after they enter the environment. And we have seen that in some systems, like Lake Ontario, the plastic actually becomes a little more toxic after it spends a couple months out in the lake. And likely that's because of the accumulation of different toxins onto the surface of the plastic. Whereas interestingly, in a, you know, stormwater retention pond, it becomes less toxic, which is not what we predicted at all. So there's a lot of potential interaction once the plastic gets out into the environment as well. So just looking at the pristine form of a water bottle or a bottle cap doesn't always tell us the whole picture, because once it gets into the environment, there are a lot of interactions that happen out there. And so the organisms are being stressed not only by the plastic, but also potentially by other toxins that are in the environment.
I think one of the harder parts for the public to grapple with here is that a lot of this is unseen. I mean, I think, Dr. Tyler, we remember the images of, aquatic life struggling with the plastic holders of six packs of Coke, that would end up in the water, and it's strangling a beak or a nose or a breathing area, and we've seen that, and it's awful. We've seen all kinds of images, but when it comes to microplastics, if we can't see it, do we not engage with it as viscerally? Is that a concern of yours? I mean, do we need to sort of open up our imaginations here about what's actually happening to organisms everywhere?
I think you're right about that. That and I think that that's true with a lot of environmental issues. But it really is this unseen problem, especially as the particles get smaller and smaller and smaller. And we certainly all remember the images of the six pack holder, and I think many people still cut up their six pack holders before they put them in the garbage because of those horrible images. And the ingestion of big pieces of plastic, whales with 60 pounds of plastic in their stomach. I think we don't think as much about things that happen on this very small scale. I study the biogeochemistry of aquatic ecosystems, and we're seeing that the plastic actually influences how the nutrients move through a system. So it's actually affecting the microbes in a system. So all of the bacteria and very, very small organisms that are in an ecosystem that are actually very important to how the ecosystem works. So I think we need the impact on the big organisms to show up as a way to be this big red flag of, wow, this is what's happening. But I think we also need to look at it at the level of the whole ecosystem to understand what's going on.
Back to email from listeners. Greg emails to say, different Greg, not Greg Medeski. Greg emails to say, should I stop using a Roundup in my yard for fear of the impact on bees? Matt?
As a broad statement, yes. Get away from Roundup. One of the things they found about Roundup is it can have antimicrobial properties, which again can screw up the microbiome of bees if it doesn't just kill them directly. But the other thing is relevant to our conversation. It probably comes in a plastic bottle. So yes, stop using it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Roundup is still sort of ubiquitous, though, isn't it, Matt? I mean, are in the farming community that you're pretty familiar with, are you seeing a shift in product usage?
Yeah, you know, and I'm sorry if I came off a little snarky there.
No, I don't think so. I think you were blunt.
You know, Roundup, I will say this, all pesticides, I think pesticides in many ways are like plastic in that there is value to being, you know, for growing food, for maintaining the structured environments where we produce food and other plant things. We need to be able to control pests, and we need to be able to control viruses and funguses and all these sorts of things. And applying some sort of substance is helpful for doing that. Roundup, and I should say this, Roundup as an herbicide, because that's what it is. It's an herbicide that's made to kill plant material. Roundup as an herbicide can be valuable for targeted application for getting rid of invasive plant species and other things like that. I think where it becomes problematic is when it's not targeted, but just broadly sprayed, and it's not in response to something in particular, but done just kind of, you know, I'm going to get ahead of the game and I'm just going to spray everything. Mm-hmm. So and, you know, in some ways, I think this kind of comes back to the question of plastic, too. Has plastic been bad? No, it's allowed us to do a lot of things. And the question is, you know, the question at this point is, what might be the worst impacts? What sources can we change immediately? And what other sort of sources of plastic are we okay leaving for a little while until we can catch up on those? So I think it's being very thoughtful about whether it's pesticides or whether it's plastics, being very thoughtful about how we use these things and how we, you know, go about changing these things.
Mm-hmm. Kathy from Chi Lai writes to ask, is Professor Tyler aware of any research being done on whether inhalation of microplastics or nanoparticles is responsible for the increased incidence of asthma in this country? Again, that's Kathy in Chi Lai. Dr. Tyler?
That's a very good question, and I am not aware of any studies that have looked directly at that link, but I know that there are a lot of people looking at the potential for inhalation of plastics and the potential influence on lung tissue, nasal passages. So to my knowledge right now, there's not been a study that's come out to indicate that there is a link with asthma, but it's certainly plausible and worth study.
More research needed.
Yes.
Yeah, Kathy, a very good question, and I appreciate that. Greg Medeski, a question about plastic in the Great Lakes. It's come up a couple of times in this program, and I know that some of our reporting team at WXXI have focused on this at various points over the years. How much do we know now about how much in the way of plastics, microplastics, et cetera, is in the Great Lakes?
Yeah, we certainly know a lot more than we did, 5 years ago. there was a big news article from Sherry Mason looking at, you know, plastics and bottled water and beer and things around, the Buffalo area. A lot of work has been done since then to examine, how plastic moves in the Great Lakes. Matt Hoffman over at RIT there has actually done some modeling about, you know, how different microplastics might be distributed in Lake Erie or Lake Ontario. And they can be basically be distributed all across the lake, you know, all around the shorelines. It's not like the ocean where they'll have like a garbage patch, but there's quite a bit of plastic on the shorelines, as most people will tell you walking up and down the beach.
Well,
yeah, I guess I could add.
Yeah, please do, Dr. Tyler. Yeah,
yeah,
that I think Matt and Matt Hoffman at RIT and Eric Hedinger did an estimate that they estimated about 10,000 tons of plastic enter the Great Lakes every year, And that's a, you know, it's a kind of a first order approximation based on how much plastic is produced, mismanagement of plastic. But there's really a big research gap in how much does actually enter the lake. And then, you know, Greg did a nice job summarizing that in the lakes, these particles tend not to accumulate like they do in these big ocean gyres, where you see these pictures of kind of this giant plastic soup out in the middle of the ocean. A lot of it, because of the wind and the way the currents go, tends to accumulate closer to the shore. And a lot of it ends up on the bottom. And, you know, one of the other differences is that, you know, seawater is slightly more dense, which makes the plastic stay floating a little longer than freshwater systems. So it's more likely to sink. But some of the other work we're doing is trying to understand how long does it take to sink? And we're doing both modeling efforts, you know, in Matt Hoffman and his PhD student are looking at models to try to estimate how much stays in the water column with then the potential to leave to go out to the ocean, or how much will sink and ultimately be retained in the lake. And it really varies by the type of plastic as well, whether because most plastic is right around the same density as water. So it depends once it starts to get covered with microbes and algae, often zebra mussels will attach to plastic, and then it will sink and stay in the system.
Well, with all of the knowledge that we've collected, but we're still, you know, sort of trying to answer questions that are unanswered. What's the impact of these microplastics on our bodies and our health long term? How are bees, how are pollinators impacted by what they are carrying around? How are food systems going to be impacted? These are big, hard questions, and presumably eventually there will be answers for all of them. But the question becomes, do you make policy before you have those answers? And before the hour's up here, I just want to ask our guests if they have any thoughts sort of about that challenge, because we look at California, and I'm looking at a story from calmatters.org about some of the approaches in other places about this. Let me read this story. I found this very interesting. Quote, California is poised to issue the world's first guidelines for microplastics in drinking water, despite no data on how plentiful they are in the state, no scientific agreement on how to test water for them, and little research on their health risks. Under a 2018 state law, California must require 4 years of testing for microplastics in drinking water, and the state must consider guidelines to help water providers and consumers determine what levels may be safe to drink. Now the State Water Resources Control Board is blazing a trail to issue a preliminary health-based threshold and testing method by July 1st. The state's aim is to take a precautionary approach, moving to tackle potential threats posed by microplastics. So they know that they don't have answers for all of the big questions, but they're going to create policy anyway before they get some of the big answers. Essentially, sort of safety first, perhaps there. Matt Kelly, I mean, I know all three of our guests, you're not all policy setters, but I am curious to know what you think about the idea of crafting policy to deal with some of these answers that we don't have yet. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, that CalMatters story was an interesting one. You know, I would never advocate making policy before we have sound information to base that policy on, sound understanding. We don't want policy based on feeling, right? We need policy based on the reality of things that are happening in the world to affect real change and really, really meaningful change. So, you know, I will always be an advocate for acquiring, you know, real world information and data upon which to make policy. But that being said, I think we are living in what for all of us are unprecedented times. If we were not continuing to pump tons and tons and tons and tons of plastic into the environment, if we weren't continuing to increase the temperature of the planet by X degrees per year, yeah, sure, maybe we could take 25 years to figure this out, right? But we're kind of running out of time. And, you know, we've acknowledged that microplastic is an invisible problem, potentially, right? You just can't see it. It's not like you go to the tap water and you're like, oh, microplastic today. I won't drink that glass. You can put it down. You just don't see it. And so I think there has to be a precautionary approach to many of these things. I think we have to use the best information that we have, given the sort of short time frame we're working with.
30 seconds, Dr. Tyler, go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Matt said, that it, you know, setting policy before you have all the information is fairly challenging, although precautionary. I think in this case, the policy is a little bit getting ahead of where we are with the science and the ability to adequately measure how much is there. But at the same time, we do know that we're continuing to put more and more and more in the environment. So the problem is only getting worse while we're trying to figure it out. So there needs to be a balance in how we approach it.
Greg, where do people find you online with Parvario?
Yep. You can just go to www.parvario.com, P-A-R-V-E-R-I-O. And if you'd like to find out more about us, you can sign up for our mailing list.
Greg, thanks for the expertise. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Of course.
Dr. Tyler, very much appreciated. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Matt Kelly with the B Report. Thank you, sir. Nice talking to you.
Hey, good talking to you, too. This was a great conversation. Thanks, guys.
Let's be good to the bees, everybody. Rob Braden, Emery Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying have a great weekend. We're back with you Monday on member-supported Public Radio.